Wow.
Good job.
They were right.
For you, they must
Mr. Hoffman and Mr. Price want to get going.
There you go, Scott. Let's get it going.
Meeting readjourned.
Who's going to do it?
So before we jump into the next agenda item, Tim's going to kick that off. I wanted to get the clarification on the tips. I got it exactly wrong, so everything I said, flip that back.
Wow.
John was right, so it was. it's not the yield on it. The yield on a 10-year TIPS is like 0.4. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is like 2.4. That's the
all right. That makes good sense to me. Okay, thank you.
My money's on John.
Same here. After I said that,
I'm really impressed that you like
me. Yeah, that's great. And I learned something there.
Well, TIPS are tricky.
TIPS are tricky. Yeah. Directions.
TIPS aren't for kids. Is that what you're saying?
All right. I'm going to kick off the next agenda item here, talking about the asset allocation and the annual capital markets review. And this is the first time we've done it this way, so I thought it bears repeating. I mean, we've been over this a number of times, but it is different from past practice, so it kind of bears walking through the first time. In the past, when we've done asset allocation studies, they have largely been exercises we do every 3 to 5 years. They're periodic check-ins, make course corrections, nothing really happens to those targets in an intervening period. Now, under the FFP model, because we size our liquidity program in terms of number of years of benefit payments, and every year we take a fresh look at the actuarial projections on that, that dictates that portfolio gets resized every year. We start with 4 years, we draw down through a year's worth of benefit payments, we take a look at adding a new fourth year. That fourth year is going to change in terms of dollar size. So every year we're going to take a fresh look at that and say, that new fourth year coming in, how big is it? How much money do we need to set aside for that? That dictates the size of our liquidity program. And then that also gives us an opportunity to say, now if we simply just resize the liquidity program and kept everything else pro rata, that's probably a very reasonable approach, but it does give us a chance to say, has anything changed over the past year? Are there any material differences to say we might want to make a tweak here? And I know last time we had this conversation, I think Rusty and Jerry brought up the points of saying, we're not going to be moving all over the place. And I think you'll see, we're not moving all over the place. We're simply saying, have valuations changed so dramatically that it's now an opportune moment to make a modest course correction? And I'm going to let Varys kind of step through the process here. But I do want to highlight on my cover memo, this will be an annual process. You'll be seeing us every year. If there are any changes to the growth or diversifying sub-portfolio sizes or compositions, that'll be a joint recommendation from CIO and from Varys. We want you to have multiple voices involved in that. And I'm always going to give you that table that's on page 2 there that talks about what is the new tranche coming in. We've already funded up the liquidity program with about 3.5 years worth of liquidity payments. We did that in December. We're kind of taking a July to June normal year. So the fact that we did it at the end of the year, we didn't do 6 months of benefit payments funding. So now we get to this July. We're going to have a new tranche coming in. And it's about $272 million additional that we're going to need to be defeasing with the liquidity program. So the liquidity program is going to go from about 24% to about 27% of the overall plan here. And we're going to take a look at that every year. So this year, modest growth in the liquidity program, about plus 3% there. And the reason I should step back. We're not on a fiscal year that goes, July 1 to June 30th. The reason we do this is this is when we get the prepayments from the employers. So we get the prepayments in July. If we're going to make big funding decisions, it makes sense to do that when we have a big cash infusion. So we always are going to be defeasing the next fourth year in July, concurrent with having that money coming in.
Yes. So on that, when prepayments are made, typically they're done in July. Is there any guarantee that employers going forward will always make them July? Because there's legislation in process now where it might change it where they can spread out the prepayments?
Yeah. Well, right now we've adapted to the current environment. Now, there's nothing that says we have to do this in July. What we have said is we're going to go every year, we're going to top it up. Now, we happen to be timing it out to July at this point in time. If that gets spread out and we no longer have a one-time cash infusion and it's more spread out, then we'll take a look at that and adapt to that environment. And this is pretty malleable here. We can be topping it up whenever we want. I simply wanted to adapt to the current environment of, you know, several hundred million dollars are coming in each July. That makes sense to make your big trades right around that cash flow.
So I had a question. I want to follow up on Jerry's earlier question, because I think, I mean, relative to what it's been, this is a more active process.
Yes.
I think, and that's a statement, not a question, but yes. So to Jerry's earlier point, then the flux in the data that we see, whether it be quarter to quarter or semi-annual look to semi-annual, does take on a greater meaning then, right? I mean, that I think that was what, at least I detected what you were asking, Jerry, what was, in terms of the data that we see and absorb and how we react to it, in the environment we're going into, that we're entering into, we're going to have a more, I don't know if the right word is active, but I'd say there's a more active approach to managing even the longer-term investments if they're showing disturbing trends based on the kind of annual analysis you're going to do for that sort of evergreen fourth year that keeps flopping in, right? That it's the one you're doing the reset four-year window to look at.
Yeah, I would say that the time horizon varies by the portion of the portfolio. The liquidity program is paying our current benefit payments.
Right.
The time horizon there is 30 days, basically. We're looking at that nonstop.
Right.
That is, money is flowing through the system. It's very operational. It's very transactional. That gets the highest touch look. And that's reflected in the fact that I'm now providing the board with monthly reports on the functioning of that portfolio.
Right.
I would say the growth portfolio is actually being pushed much farther out on the time horizon there. That one, we can deploy capital far, far into the future. Because we now have the flexibility, our benefit payments are defeased. We know that money is available to be deployed much farther into the future. We can accept more illiquidity, which we've seen in the adoption of a higher allocation to private equity and private credit. So that one is much farther out into the future. The diversifying one is really, you know, we're going to talk about that next. Then that's where we're going to be saying this needs to offset the growth portfolio's volatility a little bit. But importantly, it's going to be our pool of capital to draw from for rebalancing into the growth portfolio if we see a market drawdown there. So I think it is, the time horizon changes given the portion of the portfolio you're looking at. Very short time horizon liquidity, very long time horizon on growth, and somewhere in the middle on the risk side of the equation, the risk diversifying side of the equation.
Okay, that's helpful. I appreciate that.
So with that, Ed's going to have some numbers to talk about how we build in that next incremental $272 million worth of liability payments that are going to happen in 2021. And make some recommendations around capital markets. But I think start with, you know, what has changed in the past year on the capital markets forecast.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So if we can turn to the second book, which is titled Asset Allocation Review. I'd actually like to ask you first to turn to tab 2, page 22. The slide is titled Methodology. The reason why I want to start here is just to give you a refresher on how this is done, because it's a what we call a building block approach, where we take a look at an individual asset class, and in order to build an expectation for that asset class, we start with a building block approach where every asset class essentially begins with some assumption about cash returns, inflation. What is the most fundamental level of interest rates in our economic environment? And then let's think about things from there as we get into credits, bonds, what type of credit spread needs to be built into that. When we get into equities, how do we think about building in the equity risk premium? And so what this page is, and apologies for the small font, it is a bit of an eye chart, but it gives you each asset class and how that building block approach works. And so it's not just a case of saying, golly, emerging markets have done well this past year, so our assumption going forward comes down a bit. Yeah, that factors in, but it's also a combination of dividend yield, what the price-to-earnings multiple looks like, which captures that valuation component, et cetera. And so just depending on the asset class, there are different components. And those components are basically the same year to year. We just update the data. And so when we turn to page 26, we can see how this year's capital market assumptions have changed relative to last year. And you're going to see, I think, three interesting bars here that all are in the negative side. U.S. large, which is U.S. large cap equities, down 1.2%. That's on the farthest left. Emerging markets down 2.6, and high yield credit down 2.6. So those are all meaningful changes. And when we look at it and say, golly, we're looking at 10-year assumptions, and should they change that much year to year? Well, the numbers that you're seeing change here are higher volatility asset classes. So yeah, we should expect change here. They are higher volatility. These things change, and it would actually be incorrect for us to have really stable predictors on very volatile asset classes. So these things are changing with purpose and intent, and it makes sense. So emerging markets coming down 2.6. You might expect that to lead us to believe let's reduce our exposure to emerging markets. High yield corporate credit coming down 2.6, that has a two-prong effect. One is directly on high yield, but also high yield is used in the calculation of private credit. And if you remember last year, we were allocating a sizable increase to private credit. We effectively have zero in the portfolio today. Now with this change, we're going to look at it and say that comes off a bit. Another part of the story on private credit is not related to these numbers, is that the rationale behind it, I think, probably makes a little bit more sense. As we talked about banking deregulation, if banks are allowed to get into this private credit space, they were once in this private credit space. If they're allowed to get back in, that's a new competitor competing for these market. That would also drive us to believe returns would come down. We're not seeing that yet. But in general, as you think about it and say, do we want to have private credit exposure? Yeah, we want some, probably meaningful, but this reduces what that exposure is. And going forward, we might think about that in kind of a tactical way.
Question regarding that. Regulations regarding that stopped the banks from going into that into the credit market, or what stopped them?
The regulations made the cost of that business very high.
Regulations did make the cost of it very high.
Right. So,
and Trump is going to remove regulations, from what I understand or what I see in print. So if he does that, is that not going to bring banks back into it?
It's an at the margin kind of thing. So each bank will make that decision on their own. They'll look at the cost, and if regulations change and are lightened, that cost of doing business there will come down. Now that individual bank is making the decision, can we make enough profit? Is it worth the risk to enter back into that business? So if they go and look at the past 5 years and say, gosh, returns have been fantastic, defaults have been really low, let's take on that risk, you could see them going after it.
Which would limit our ability to go after it.
It would bring more competitors into the space and change the pricing. Yeah.
Okay. Just so I understand our the chart we're looking at, it's 217 versus 216 return forecast. Are we talking about 217 the first 2 months of result, or are we talking about 217 projecting from here and then comparing it to what we projected in 216?
It was the 2016 10-year forecast for each asset class compared to the 2017 10-year forecast for each asset class.
Thank you
for clarifying that. Yes. Okay, so that gives you a little bit of a heads up in terms of what we're seeing change in the assumptions. As we turn back, I think Tim highlighted all of the key points. We could jump to page 6 behind tab 1. This is the asset allocation analysis. Probably easiest to open it up to 6 and 7 simultaneously as these pages work together. And so on page 6, just working left to right, we have our current portfolio as of 12/31, our phase 1 targets, very close, slightly different, and our 2016 FFP 4-year model, which we accepted earlier last year. Now there are two different approaches being shown here, increased liquidity and rescale. This portfolio mix basically says, okay, we recognize that we have to increase the liquidity portfolio. Let's do that and then just rescale all of the other positions proportionately. So that's why we have a lot more decimal points in this. That's what's driving that. As we rescale, we get some of that. And then alternative mix is basically saying, okay, well, we'll rescale the liquidity portfolio, get it up to the 27% we want, but let's make some changes, taking into consideration the capital market assumptions have changed, and see what's the most efficient portfolio now that we can create. And so alternative mix is really what we're recommending here. And so some of the changes you can see just working from the top as we compare alternative mix column to the 2016 FFP four-year column. These are really the changes that we're comparing here. U.S. large stays the same at 6, U.S. small stays the same at 0. International developed increases 2%, so we go up to 12% from 10. Emerging markets stays the same at 10. And so even though we saw emerging markets come down in our capital market assumptions, these columns to the right show that this is still a desirable asset class. We're seeing 8.6% projected return, standard deviation 27, Sharpe ratio 0.35, and the correlations and the correlation matrix certainly comes into play here in terms of creating the efficient allocation overall for the plan. So maintaining that 10% allocation. We then get into global equity and high yield, staying the same at 0, private equity staying the same at 12, and here's where we see the big delta, private credit coming down from what was 16 down to 12%. And again, these are positions that will take time to build. These are those private commitments that will be called over the course of years, and so getting to that 12% or 16% is likely a four-year endeavor. Did you have a question?
So the reason why that's come down, I mean, the return looks decent, and but because of what you just showed us, that the anticipation is if regulations come down and it becomes more competitive, we're not going to be looking at that kind of a yield probably going forward. So even though it looks good on paper right now, in the future it won't be as good. So that's one of the reasons why you pared that down.
Right now we did it just for the numbers, just based on that. The dialogue about what's happening in banking and if it actually comes to fruition would likely impact our 2018 or 19 or 20 capital market assumptions. So we're comfortable making this recommendation here today because the 12% is just based on the data that we know, and we always want to be research-based in our approach, so we're going to stick to that. And also recognizing that we're not making the 12% commitment today, that it would take time to build that over time. It would take time to find the strategies and select them and everything. So we'll actually have a window to start getting, putting our toe in the water, stepping into the shallow end, and wading in a little bit before we end, as we watch that dialogue play out.
I would say, you know, a year ago it was a great entry point to this asset class. Now it's a good entry point, and we just want to recognize that and say, all right, a year ago if we could have deployed the capital, would have been a great time to go in. Now it's still a good time, just not as good as it was.
Influence of deregulating.
So the remainder of page 6 stays the same as we compare the alternative mix, and then page 7 gives us the results of these portfolios. So let's start on the left-hand side here. Current portfolio, 6% return expectation, standard deviation of 11.25, and then return to standard deviation, just kind of a rough metric of how much return we're expecting for the risk that we're seeking. First percentile return 1 year. This is the first percentile being the bottom percentile 1 year return expectation, so kind of a shock. What could we expect to see, a 1 in 100 year kind of thing, which we know happens more common than that in the markets, but down 23.6% there. Sharpe ratio 0.39 and a real return of 3.93. We think this is important because our assumption for inflation is 2.1. And so when we take the 2.1 and strip it out of the 6.03, that's how we get a 3.93%. Your actuary has a different inflation assumption, is looking at a different time frame, but as you think about hitting your assumed rate of return, which is 7.25, right?
Seven.
Thank you. 7 minus a 3% inflation, they're looking at about a 4% real return. So 3.93 versus 4, we're in the same ballpark. Phase 1 target column is very similar to that as we work through phase 1, and then the 2016 FFP 4-year gives us a little bit of breathing room over that. So forecast 10-year return of 6.8 with a real return of 4.7.
Ed, we are assuming on inflation 2.75, by the way.
That's right. That's right.
Still
that came
in ballpark,
down.
But yeah. a little bigger spread.
Thank you. Thank you. So we're looking at a 4.25% real on the portfolio.
Yep.
So the alternative mix column, which is also boxed there, gives us the comfort around that 6.83% expected return, standard deviation of 10.54, Sharpe ratio of 0.48, a shock in any given year of up to 22%, we think is possible, and a real return of 4.7% over 10 years.
That would be good.
So this is a first look right now. We're not asking the board to adopt this today. This is a first look. There's a couple more conversations to be had, but just kind of so you can see where the thinking is heading today.
The next pages take us through some stress tests and historical scenario analysis. Those are all insightful. Stress test is basically saying, what if this one thing changes on page 8, like the U.S. dollar increases by 20% or global equities sell off 20%, what's going to happen to our portfolio? And you can see that it would suffer under each of these scenarios. Of course, we're not picking the happy scenarios. We're picking things to test us. The side note with any stress test is that never does one thing happen. It's always in coordination with other things. If the U.S. dollar increased by 20%, there would be a response in the equity market and the credit markets and what have you. So therefore, pages 9 and 10 get to some historical scenario analysis saying, well, what happened when, or what would our portfolio do if we were in 2009 again, July to January? And so we have a number of those scenarios outlined as well.
Hey, talk on this thing. I was asking this the other day. We've had like the subprime. We've had way back when the savings and loan. We've had the dot-com penny stock. Yeah. Now the technology's better and stuff. Is it, do you foresee any, let's say, corrupt things happening, like let's say the penny stock kind of thing? Or
I wouldn't have predicted any of the past ones. I can tell you that. They've all seemed to have amazed, partially due to the creativity, the lack of oversight, the willingness people are willing to go to, the lengths they're willing to go to seek a return. It's quite surprising. You hear of the technologies like high-frequency trading and cybersecurity and those kinds of things. We see flash crashes now. What do those mean? How do they play out? Who knows? The one thing we do see regularly is the pendulum swing on lending. And so we see that it gets very tight. No one wants to lend. Economic activity comes to a standstill. And then it starts to loosen up. And lending starts happening again. And then it goes too far. People take on too much debt. And then they can't pay their bills. And then we have a modest correction in the market or a modest recession or what have you. And all of a sudden, we enter a new credit cycle. So we regularly see credit cycles happen. We regularly see economic cycles happen. So these things will come about again. We'll see darker days ahead, I'm sure.
Thank God you said it, not me.
Page 11 gives basically a chart showing asset allocation. Pages 12 and 13 tie us back to our earlier discussion on risk perspective in the portfolio. With page 12, taking a look at how our portfolio is positioned and where the sources of risk are coming from. And you can see how that changes. Domestic equity is the major contributor today and in phase one targets. Going forward, that will be much less, and we'll see international equity tick up. And you can also see that these bar charts come down a bit. So we're currently at 11.2%. We're looking at something more of 10.5. Are those numbers materially different over 10 years? A little. You know, none of this is crystal ball. None of it's perfect. So we always have to be careful about the precision because we can print these numbers out to 4 decimal points, but that doesn't mean they're that accurate. So 11.2 versus 10.5, we feel like we're modestly taking a little bit of risk off the table there. And then page 13 shows contribution to risk. Again, this is highlighting that most of our risk is coming from our equity exposures, either explicitly investing in domestic and international equity or the equity component to credit and the other asset classes that we have. So this paints that picture. here, alternative mix has 77.4 equity, and currently we're at 87.3. So this does show how this mix dials that down. And the middle column is the 2016 FFP 4-year, and you can see that the alternative mix is roughly in line with that. So a bit of a changing of the weights here from a risk perspective.
Just a point of clarification, just on the presentation of the memo, it keeps referring to recommendations, but then it also indicates that there's no action being taken today. Mm-hmm. So it's for information only. So are you asking for a direction or a
call it, this is a framework. We're going to have a discussion about the composition of the diversifying sub-portfolio that's modeled out here. Get some direction around that, come back with education, and then we'll do a final adoption of this in May. So unless we're getting strong feedback to the contrary, this is our framework. There's some fine-tuning to be done, education to be done today in April with a final adoption in May.
Yeah. But it's not so much a recommendation as it is a direction.
This is where the this is the direction of the recommendation. How about that?
Yeah.
No. Or the recommended direction.
I thought I had it until you cleared it up.
Good play.
Yeah, this is where this is kind of where the current thinking is heading. We're getting strong feedback to the contrary. We'll take another look at this. Otherwise, there's a few other small slots to handle, but this is where it'll end up in May.
I like when Yogi Berra starts off a speech by quoting Tim Price.
Yeah, that's right. Or Gertrude Stein. Is there a there there?
You'd be fun in, like, confirmation hearings, Jerry.
Oh, no. As a witness or
interrogator? Yeah, I see you as a witness. Yeah, very entertaining witness.
Call it a first reading. How about that?
First reading.
Good.
Thank you.
All right. Ed will be featured as Sackers on a panel.
Yes.
Is it on tips?
No, no, it's not.
Wow. You're bad.
You're so bad.
That session.
You're on a good roll there for a while.
It's a tough audience.
Yeah. David will be tri-tips.
Tough room.
That's deserved, so I really have nothing to say.
All right.
Okay. We ready? Good. Are we now with Mr. Price in item 8?
You are now with me.
Okay.